I'd like to call the committee back to order, let me apologize for not being able to be here this morning. I was in Judiciary Committee presenting a bill that is pertinent to our bill, so I appreciate the consideration of the committee. What we're going to do today, yesterday we left sort of in the middle of a discussion on Senator Newman's bill. And so I'm going to just ask Senator Newman to take that bill up again. My hope is, and in consultation with Senator Newman, that he will withdraw the bill or the amendment. It is my hope that he would be willing, and my conversation with him, he seems to be willing, that we would take that up as a separate bill sometime after the budget process is completed. I just believe that given the number of people that we want to hear from today, that discussion could be quite lengthy. And so rather than complete it right now, we are going to withdraw that amendment and then hear from several boards who have presentations on fees that would be in the budget. And following that, we will take public testimony and not do any amendments until the conclusion of the public testimony. So there will not be any further amendments until sometime later this afternoon. I understand we have a list in your agenda. I believe it is complete. We're going to take testifiers in the order that is on the list. And given the nature of the deadline that we have and the number of people who wish to testify, the testimony will by necessity be brief. We would like to hear people's opinion and their concerns and perhaps support even on issues that are in the bill. But we would ask you to limit your comments to about 2 minutes. And that way we can have some chance of getting through and dealing with amendments. So that's the idea for today. So at this time, I'd like to recognize Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure of the amendment number. I didn't bring it with me.
25. It's 16.
It's the A16 A16 amendment.
Yeah, A16 amendment, Mr. Chairman. I withdraw at this time.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to invite the representatives from the boards that are here. The first one would be Mr. Spicer from the Chiropractic Board. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm actually Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. I'm also the Chair of the Health Licensing Board's Policy Committee, which deals with legislative issues and interagency relations. And if I could just speak really briefly and have then our fiscal analyst, Julie Vangsness, speak briefly, and then Dr. Spicer, myself, and Shirley Brecken will speak. The boards, first of all, welcome the opportunity to be here and to explain our budget proposals. As executive branch agencies, we, of course, support the governor's proposal, which actually included the concept of creating a dedicated special fund for the boards in the special revenue fund. We are not our agencies are not funded out of the general fund. We're funded out of the special revenue fund. And we worked with Minnesota Management Budget and the governor's office to create the legislation that's in the governor's budget. However, we understand that both the House and the Senate have not included that in their omnibus health and human service budget bills. And so that's why we think it's important for Ms. Vangsness to talk a little bit about how that language was crafted, and if we're going to go back to the old way of funding, why it's important that some things that are not included in the Senate bill are included in that bill. And so I'll turn it over to Ms. Vangsness.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Ms. Vangsness.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Vangsness, and I'm the accounting coordinator for all of the health boards. And with changing the process from what the governor's budget has in it, from going from a non-dedicated funding to a dedicated funding, and if in the Senate bill going back to the old funding, the numbers that are currently listed in the budget just include base funding from last year. And so we have several changes that were submitted that under the governor's plan would have been included. And so we want to make sure that we've addressed them here. And I'm going to just go down the list. I can provide specific documentation to staff to include or to help answer some of the questions. The Board of Dentistry has a couple of changes needed. They total $110,000 the first year and $95,000 the second year. And it's to cover costs related to replacement of some old computers and the maintenance costs that we have in our current database. It's hiring a part-time dental therapist coordinator to handle some of the individual work that was done out of when session was passed in 2009 that licensed the dental therapist, and we don't have really any staff. We need additional staff to help with that process. It's to continue some funding on a part-time dental consultant that we have in-house. This individual helps review any complex cases and helps in the complaint processing. And then some funding to cover expert professional expenses when we need to hire an expert witness during the complaint and investigative process. Another item that's included in the dentistry is to actually move the health professional services program that currently is under the Emergency Medical Services Board to the Board of Dentistry, and there's no change in their funding. It's just actually placing them under a different board, and that was another item that was included in the governor's budget. The Board of Marriage and Family Therapy, in 2002, fees were set in statute, but they were never really listed, and so we've identified and would like to codify the fees so that they are actually listed out in statute. And then this board is also requesting a $25,000 increase in 2012 only to cover rulemaking costs. Now, they've received the $25,000 this year and were unable to complete the process with the new executive director coming on board, and we don't think that we'll be able to complete it by June 30th. We do not have carryover authority, so we need the money reappointed or reallocated to us then in 12. For the Board of Nursing, they have a couple of different change items that were included in the governor's budget, and that was the ability to receive grant money, and so we need the authority to spend that money. Also to accept registration fees for conferences, and again, the authority then to spend that. They also are requesting $50,000 just for a base increase to help cover costs such as things that we paid to other state agencies, the Administrative Hearings Office, Office of Technology, and also just to meet some of the day-to-day operational expenses. And then part of their increase was also to cover the costs of the authority to do the criminal background checks that they currently don't do. The Board of Nursing Home Administrators had proposed a one-time $44,000 increase to cover rules. They need to do some rule changes. It's been since 2000, since anything has been done, and it's time to just take a look at those. The Board of Pharmacy has a couple of different increases. One of them is just a small base increase of $97,000 each year, and then $136,000 to cover the replacement of a pharmacy surveyor. The individual retired a few years ago, and funds were never available to refill that position. So those were some of the other increases there. We also have, for the Board of Physical Therapy, they, too, are requesting a one-time rulemaking expense of $44,000 the first year. The last time their rules were updated was in 1990, and it's time to make some changes to them. And then they are requesting $50,000 to support either hiring expert witnesses through contract or bringing a staff on board part-time to help with the investigative case review and the disciplinary actions on complaints. the Board of Social Work, they have another bill going through to license exempt professionals. So if that bill doesn't go through, their increase would not be needed. If it does go through, they would need an appropriation increase of $115,000 the first year and $132,000 the second year. The Board of Veterinary Medicine is requesting a $33,000 increase the first year and $34,000 the second year, and that's to cover increasing the current executive director from a part-time position to a full-time position, and also to assist in the cost of complaint investigation or in complaint expert witnesses, also to pay for the per diems and mileage to the board members that will be a result of additional meetings needing due to the higher complaints. And then the Administrative Services Unit has a couple of joint increases. One of them is $225,000 to cover the retirement for the anticipated retirees through all of the boards. And typically, every 2 years, we come forward with that request, and funds then are transferred from the ASU to each of the boards as retirees retire. They also have two other joint requests. One of them is to create and implement a common shared licensing, regulatory, and information management system. This would be a one-time request the first year of $800,000, and then after that, $300,000 the second year, and then dropping to $50,000 after that to maintain a system. That would then put all 15 of the boards on one platform using the same system. And then the last of the requests is also a joint request that would be needed in 2013 to cover the adapters to connect to the OET e-licensing system. And we anticipate that to be funds needed in 2013 of $761,000. We received the information from OET when we were calculating the cost to connect to that system. And then another $100,000 in 2014. And then after that, that cost would drop away. Those are all of our requests for all of the boards. Are there any questions?
Ms. Vangsness, I appreciate your being here. I understand that we are having or may already have some amendments prepared that we will take up pertaining to some of the items that you've mentioned. I did want to ask you one question. You mentioned a couple of cases where there was rulemaking that needed to be done. I recall one of them was a cost of $44,000, and I can't. Why is there a significant cost to do rulemaking?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I might answer that, the Board of Pharmacy is currently engaged in a rulemaking process to really update our rules, many of which are obsolete. A lot of the cost deals with, I think, staff time involved in it. But beyond that, Minnesota is, I've been told, the only state where if 25 people request it, we have to have a hearing before an administrative law judge, which was the case for the Board of Pharmacy. A hearing before an administrative law judge, when you pay for all the fees that the Office of Administrative Hearing charges us, can well exceed $10,000 just for that. We also have the cost of publishing the rules in the state register. In our case, we wanted to do a very comprehensive rule change, again, because many of our rules were obsolete. And the cost of publishing the rules, if you don't get an exemption from that, which we fortunately could, got an exemption to publish the entire rules. If we would have had to publish the entire rules, that would have been over $10,000 just to publish the rules in the state register.
Right. Thank you.
Yep.
Are there other questions? Yes, Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weiberg, don't we own the state register?
Mr. Weiberg.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, the state register is certainly a state entity, but just as we pay the Attorney General's office when they provide services to us, or we are passing along a surcharge, a significant surcharge, to the Office of Enterprise Technology for what they're doing, the state register charges us for anything that we publish in the state register. We have to pay that to them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Several years ago, when I was chairing state and local government, we changed the law so we could, so that local governments could publish a summary in, you know, whatever publication they are required to put their legal notices, and then allow them to put, you know, further information like on the website or something like that. And we might want to think about that for future future bills, because that's a huge cost. And I can imagine that the pharmacy rules are probably not as complicated as some of the rules that we do for other things. So we should maybe look into that.
Mr. Chair, if I could just address that. I don't want to mislead the committee. We can get approval from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and our board was able to do that this time, so that we did just publish a summary, and the administrative law judge let us publish the full rules on our website. But if we don't get that permission is where the costs really mount up. And I think when a board is estimating what the costs are, it doesn't know in advance if it's going to get that approval. That may be why the request for the is as much as it is. We just don't know for sure.
Thank you. Ms. Vagsness, I wonder if you could comment a little bit about we have in the bill on page 131, section 16, health-related boards, administrative service unit language. And if you could perhaps just take a moment and help the committee understand what it is that we are doing there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently the administrative services unit really isn't anywhere listed in statute. And so what this bill was doing was trying to actually give us a home in 214. It does reference in other sections of 214 some of the duties of the administrative services unit, but this was to do that. And then currently our funding, we not only work with the health-related licensing boards that contribute money to the special revenue fund, we also have a few boards that are general funded, and it's our way then of being able to bill out our services to the general funded boards and be able to use those funds then to pay for our salaries for our staff. We have about 7 members on the administrative services unit, and so it's like 2 different ways of funding our unit, and it just gives us the actual authority then to do that.
Thank you. questions from the committee? Mr. Spicer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Larry Spicer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And I will be brief because I believe I'm really only here to speak to about 2 lines of the bill, which in the last one I reviewed are lines 121.15 and 16. In 2008, the legislature established the ability or the requirement to register doctors of chiropractic who had specialized and specified training to be able to perform services on animals, otherwise known as veterinary chiropractic. Since that has occurred, the board has completed its rule writing and has done so cooperatively with the veterinary profession and the veterinary board. It has established the registrations and the renewals of the registrations, including the procedures and the forms. It has set up the continuing education protocols and everything that goes along with that. And kind of consistent with the movie tagline, "If you build it, they will come," there has been a well in excess of 600% increase in the numbers of persons who have qualified and subsequently registered since this bill was passed. However, in 2008, at the time that it was passed, the fees were not set. However, I was given a clear expectation that fees would be set in the fairly near future for the registration. And so I would like to clarify that, contrary to how someone characterized this to me a little bit earlier, this is actually not a raise in a fee. This is a first establishment of the fee for the registration of the animal chiropractic and the renewals of those registrations as well.
Thank you, Mr. Spicer. I appreciate it, and I don't mean any disrespect to the folks who practice animal chiropractic or other animal lovers, but I hope this is an indication that we're going to be traveling down the path of animal mental health or animal massage therapy or other sorts of specialized treatments. But I do recall hearing this a couple of years ago in the Agriculture Committee, so I appreciate your comments. Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Spicer? Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Brecken from the Nursing Board.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I believe that if I have the right copy, the nursing board fees are listed on page 163, starting with line 28. Essentially, what this provision does is move fees from rule into statute, as well as codify some fees that the legislature had set back in 1999 that were never codified. Am I on the right page for you?
Just one moment,
okay.
Ms. Brecken. We don't have a page 163,
right.
So
this is what I printed off the internet.
That's fine. We'll find it here in a second. We're okay. Asking our counsel to give us some help here.
On the very left of your line, what line is it?
It's section 8, 148.243 fee amounts. On the left, it's 163.28, but you don't have a page 163.
It's not this.
The House bill.
Give the article and the section number.
Is it the licensing fees?
We only go
fees?
To page 160.
Is it the licensing fees?
From 20.
Mr. Chair, what's the article?
It's
and
for
the section
148.
Number?
The section of law is 148.243.
Article 7,
yep.
Section 10.
So page 123.
Mr. Albrecht, can you help us here?
Section 7, members, it's on page 123.
Page 123. Thank you. Apologize, Ms. Brecken. Line 8.
Mr. Chair, I hope we're on the same page now, or at least in the same section. What this does is codify some fees that the legislature set back in 1999, as well as move fees from rule into statute, so they are all located in one place and are available to those individuals who pay the fees. There are just a few changes that I would highlight for you. First of all, the board is proposing to delete two fees. One is the late fee of $60, and the second is a fee for a new grad permit. Those are not listed in here. The board currently collects those fees, but we are recommending eliminating those two fees. Under subdivision 5, the re-registration fee, that is a new name for the fee, and I would like to call attention to a correction. The fee is currently $145, and the board is proposing a reduction to $105, and that should be corrected in there. And then finally, subdivision 17 is an addition of a new fee for the Border State Registry. You'll recall yesterday when I was before the committee, I talked about the fact that Wisconsin residents of Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota, and South Dakota who are licensed as nurses by those boards of nursing may practice in Minnesota under the authority of that license. And this establishes a fee for that registry. It is half of the current licensure fee for licensure by endorsement or licensure by exam. The purpose of the fee will be to make changes to our database to be able to make it visible on our verification, our website for our verification service.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken. And members, I would like to address the correction of the fee amount on line 123.14. I would like to have an oral amendment offered. Would Senator Sharon be willing to offer that? Senator Sharon moves to strike 145 at the end of line 123.14 and replace it with 105. Is that correct, Ms. Brecken?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so the change in the fee is reflected in Ms. Brecken's testimony. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Brecken before we? All right. Thank you. And Mr. Weiberg?
Again, members and Mr. Chair, my name is Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. My understanding is that the committee wanted me to testify today about the proposed fee increases for the Board of Pharmacy. The board is proposing to increase the fees that we collect for our various licensees and registrants. Just to give a little bit of historical perspective, we have data on our fees going back to the mid-1950s. Between 1957 and 2001, which was the last time we had a fee increase, the average length of time between fee increases was just under 3 years. We have not had a fee increase in 10 years. We considered one in 2007 and thought we could stretch things out another 2 years. The reason we've been able to last this long without a fee increase is really twofold. One is that for a variety of reasons, our number of licensees during the first half of this last decade pretty dramatically increased. Chain pharmacies, national chain pharmacies, were putting up pharmacies all over the state. There had been a significant shortage of pharmacists, so the College of Pharmacy increased its class size by 50%. So really we were making up in volume what we weren't getting in increased fees. However, the pace of that increase has dramatically slowed, and over the last couple of years, over 50% of our new licensees have been interns and technicians. Interns pay only $20 fee one time, and technicians pay $20 a year. So the fees that we collect have not kept pace with our expenses. The other reason we've been able to last this long is we have really done our best effort to practice some fiscal discipline. We have done everything we can to move everything online to reduce printing and mailing costs. All our transactions that we can put online so far have been put online. We've decreased the number of meetings to cut down on per diem and mileage expenses. And the most significant change is the legislature actually gave us approval in 2007 to hire an additional inspector to help inspect all those additional facilities we license. But I had an inspector retire in 2009, and I have not replaced him in order to make sure that we don't exceed our appropriations. We also have had a significant increase in expenses because the legislature, on a very bipartisan basis, had the Board of Pharmacy establish the prescription monitoring program. Senator Berglund was the chief author in the Senate. Representative Abler was the chief author in the House. And we, last session, thought we had a funding mechanism all worked out. The legislature basically split the cost between the Board of Pharmacy and the board that licensed prescribers, actually included language that said that those boards could increase the fees to cover the cost for the prescription monitoring program. But after session, we were told by management and budget, no, the legislature has to list the actual specific fee increases in statute, and therefore we've been unable to raise our fees to pay for our portion of the prescription monitoring program, which is over $125,000 a year. That program, you may or may not be aware, monitors controlled substance prescriptions in the state and is a tool that prescribers and pharmacists mostly use to try to decrease prescription drug abuse by detecting people that are doctor shopping and going to multiple prescribers to get prescriptions for controlled substances and then going to multiple pharmacies. It's turned out to be a very successful program. We have over 4,000 pharmacists and prescribers who've signed up to use it. But we actually need over half of the fee increase we're asking for actually goes just to fund that program. And with that, I will take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you. As I said, we will, and I understand we do have some amendments that are drafted to address some of the issues that have been raised by any other testimony we've heard. But we will take those up following the completion of the rest of the public comment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. And members, I would like to now start to hear from the public who have indicated they wish to comment on the bill, and I am going to proceed in the order that is listed on the agenda. And so I'd like to ask Mary Reagan if she is here. Thank you. And I do want to remind you and other testifiers that we have to be brief. I appreciate your consideration. We do have a number of people and would like to try to be as expeditious as we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be as brief as I possibly can. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, co-convener of Youth Moving Forward, and the Child Wellbeing Network. I do have a handout.
Thank you. We'll have Paige distribute the testimony.
Thank you for this opportunity. As a child advocate, I'm afraid that at this point the message this bill sends is that children are not a priority. It walks away from the opportunity to ensure health care coverage for all children, eliminates funding for innovative and effective children's mental health services, abandons almost 1,000 families who have adopted children with special needs from the foster care system, as well as over 100 relative families who have been able to care for children because of the financial supports that we have offered. I'd like to start with the significant cuts to the Children and Community Services Act. And what you're getting right now is a breakdown of the impact of those cuts to each county. As you know, this is the funding that goes to counties to support child and adult protection services, which is a core government function. These are the only state dollars in Minnesota's child protection system, and we rank at the bottom of all states in state dollars in child protection. This funding's been reduced by almost 50% since 2003. And you all know how challenged the county budgets are. This will make it even more challenging. We're very concerned about the choices they're going to have to make. Another area is the children's mental health grants. You will hear plenty of testimony about those. So I only want to say that this budget eliminates funding for the very services that prevent inappropriate medication of children, inappropriate treatment services, and ensures earlier intervention. The cuts to adoption assistance and relative care assistance are especially troubling. Adoption assistance is awarded to families who adopt special needs children from the foster care system so that they can afford to give these children a permanent home. These are agreements entered into by the state with these families, and it's my understanding that we're required to honor those agreements under federal law. These cuts would affect almost 1,000 children. Not only is a cut of $5 million proposed, but the base funding needed to honor these agreements of a little over $1.5 million isn't restored. I believe, and the department I'm sure could testify to this, that this would put us out of compliance with federal law and jeopardize millions and millions of dollars in Title IV-E funding. In addition, relative care assistance cuts would impact over 100 children. Relative care assistance is provided to grandparents, aunts, and uncles of children who have been removed from their families and step up to care for them but are unable to do so because of without financial assistance. These children would remain or go into more expensive foster placements without this support. Thank you for this opportunity. We look forward to working with you to hopefully improve the budget.
Thank you, Ms. Regan. Appreciate your testimony. I apologize again for having to be brief. And we are obviously continuing this process, and we'll be working with the other body as we go forward. Thank you. Ms. Brace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify on this bill. We particularly support the Freedom of Choice and Health Care Act and the prohibition on using state funds for implementing Obamacare, which is both of those are in Article 5. These will help to counter the federal overreach now under constitutional review and coming soon to the U.S. Supreme Court. In addition, I'd like to thank Senator Hahn for the inclusion of the baby DNA language in Article 6. Written informed consent for state storage, use, and ownership of baby DNA is critical to protecting genetic privacy rights and DNA property rights. We want to thank Senator Hahn for defunding the collection and analysis of race and ethnic data on patients. Race is a social construct. You all might recall that we waited and wondered what President Obama was going to put on his U.S. Census form, whether it was black or white. What does a person with a Chinese mom and a Brazilian dad call themselves? We should not be forcing people to make racial choices that create meaningless data that can then be used to push harmful race-based policies. So we very much appreciate the elimination of those funds. We also support Senator Hand's attempt to make meaningful and real funding cuts, particularly related to all the myriad grants that we have in the state. Government, as you know, has no money that it does not first take by force from hardworking citizens who earned it. Increased government spending means increased taxes, which makes it more difficult for those who are working to use their own incomes to make their to make ends meet. Many of these workers cannot be here to defend their incomes every year as the legislature is in session because they are working, and so we appreciate this these protective cuts. We also appreciate the senator's move away from state budget draining entitlements and special interest grant funds and his move towards enabling more personal responsibility with the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program. As we all know, everyone is a shopper, even those and perhaps most certainly those with limited funds. Defined contributions create skin in the game for everyone and assure the cost consciousness we need to reduce health care spending. State programs, as you also know and have heard most recently, have been very profitable for the health plans. And some people say that these individuals who will get and become part of this Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program won't find a program out there. But I believe that if you build it, they will come. There's a lot of people that will have money to spend. Our organization supports health freedom for all. This bill assures that individuals will not be forced into government health care, and it assures that patients will always have the power of their pocketbook to buy the health care services they want and they need. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. Mr. Hokanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Tim Hokanson. I'm the administrator of Mount Olivet Adult Day Services, Mount Olivet Home, and Mount Olivet Caribbee Home in Minneapolis. I'm here to speak against the 25% cuts in PA1 rates for nursing home residents. Just quickly, so we're all on the same page, if your grandmother was in my nursing home, there's a possibility of 44 different categories that she could fall in, and a PA1 is the resident that needs the least amount of care. My facility, Mount Olivet Home, specializes in caring for low-need residents. We have 34 PA1 residents. A 25% cut would mean over $500,000 in loss for my facility. And I think you may understand how devastating that would be to a church-related nonprofit organization. What I'd like to speak to, though, however, is the PA1 resident and the gap that might occur. I know legislation is done for certain reasons, and I think the 25% cut, being it so drastic, is intended to force PA1 residents to stay in the community, and so disincent nursing homes not to accept them. Well, from my 25 years of overseeing the care of PA1s, I'm just saying it ain't going to happen. I understand the cuts might happen, but the PA1 residents are not going to stay in the community. They have come to my facility and other nursing homes because their health needs have overwhelmed the community resources that are available. As I mentioned, we have an adult daycare, and a lot of our PA1 admissions come from people who have been at our adult daycare but go back to their homes and have so many health needs that they need placement in a facility. We get several calls a day from assisted living residents and families whose loved ones have run out of money, and the assisted living managers tell them, you have to leave. You can't pay the bill. And there are very, very few assisted living organizations that accept elderly waiver money. And so they come to us, and they are PA1s. They don't have anywhere else to go. There aren't the community resources needed to keep them in the community. To be a PA1, all you have to do is be able to dress yourself, feed yourself, and get out of bed. You can have a myriad of health issues. Just on my last note, in the new health care reform, everything to deal with the elderly population coming up is to avert hospitalizations amongst the elderly. And I think if there was any way to do a study of the hospitalizations that are averted by nursing homes caring for these PA1s, the Department of Human Services would be running, not walking, running to us, not to cut our rates, but to enhance our rates, simply because of the role we will play in the future in averting hospitalizations for a very small segment of the elderly. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hokanson, for being here today. Mr. Monk.
Excuse me. Hello, Chairman Hahn and esteemed members. I'm Norm. You can call me Norm. I'm the CEO of Partnership Resources and the past president and member of Minnesota Habilitation Coalition, which represents 18,000 citizens with DD. We are small businesses called Day Treatment and Habilitation Programs, which find work, jobs, and provide opportunities for self-sufficiency. So I read that quickly. I'm not usually a reader. Everybody wants to be loved, respected, and listened to, and the citizens with developmental disabilities are no different, as you know. Every one of us wants to be self-sufficient, independent, and productive, and citizens with developmental disabilities, of course, are no different. I have my friend Richard here who's going to testify in a second. He's going to show you his demonstrate his communication device, and his staff member, Pierce, who's one of his supports. But before I do that, I'm going to tell you three very brief stories, all of which will inspire you, and inspired me in my life after tragedy struck. Two you'll identify with completely. The third is Richard's stories. The first story, briefly, is my Gramps. 8 years old, he had a stroke. We were forced to feed him, dress him, clean him. It was a left brain stroke, so it paralyzed his right side. And my grandmother, being the smartest woman in the world, she'd tell you that, put a paintbrush in his left hand, and he painted 200 scenes like this. And I was bestowed it. And then he died. But he was given an opportunity. My papa, when he was 13, I found him in the snow with my friends. He had had a heart attack, first of five heart attacks. And then, thank goodness, medical science, he became only the second person in history to receive triple bypass in New York. And I brought a shoehorn. It's about all I have left of my papa. But it represents opportunity because every day put his 12 and a half and 13s on to go to work to raise the family. These stories aren't different. They happen to all of us. The story that is different is Richard's. He came from the institutions. Nobody here should be in an institution. And we should honor all the hard work you've done to help us progress through the years. Richard has to be fed, dressed, cleaned every single day. His independence is in the hands of us and great people like Pierce here. He's also a remarkably capable man, even though he's totally vulnerable. He's an award winner on April 5th out in the Rotunda. He's won a Star Award for his technology. He works doing dishes. He's an amazing artist. Want to show his artwork?
Yeah.
And his artwork is being sought after all over the New York galleries right now. It sells between $500 and $2,000. Takes him about forever to do one, but it's remarkable. So I want to introduce Richard and end my testimony with Richard, and I appreciate so much your listening. You're on, Richard.
Hello, Chairman Hahn and committee members. My name is Richard Brown. Please listen carefully to me. People with disabilities don't want to go back in time. of our lives people have decided the quality of how we live. Now people want to attain that quality of life away from us. How can we move forward with cuts? I am hoping that the cuts that are made are fair. The cuts that have been made so far have not been fair to people working and depending on nonprofits. I want to keep coming to work. Please consider people like myself when you are balancing the budget. My quality of life depends on your decisions. Yeah. Thank you.
He wrote that himself. He's a brilliant man.
Thank you, and I'm going to ask Mr. Monk if you can conclude your testimony briefly here.
Absolutely. Last line is, don't let politics and ideology stand in the way of all the progress we've made on behalf of people like Richard. Richard is us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Norm.
Absolutely.
I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Fisher. Mr. Robert Fisher. Mr. Thompson.
Hey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ted Thompson, and I am the Senior Vice President of Public Policy and Mission Advancement for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, the Minnesota chapter. We serve nearly 10,000 Minnesotans who live with MS, and we provide programs and services, including financial aid, social workers to help navigate health plan and government bureaucracies, emergency assistance, and aids for daily living, among other things. In order to reach the people with MS throughout the state of Minnesota, we also sponsor over 80 clubs and groups to serve those folks. Since the year 2000, our chapter has raised nearly $17 million specifically for MS research. And notably, we do all of this with no tax dollars. We raise all the funds ourselves. Like others before me, I'd like to commend you and the committee for your efforts in working to address the significant budget problem you face, or we face. Obviously, no one envies your job right now, and we understand the difficult choices that you make. It's clear that reform and redesign is a necessary component for a budget solution, but it's also necessary because creating a better system that meets the needs of Minnesotans and reflects changing dynamics is the right thing to do. That said, we have serious concerns with the budget and how it's constructed because we believe that some of the approaches taken likely increase the cost to state government over both the medium and long term. I say this largely due to caps on CADI, TBI, elderly, and other waivers, coupled with significantly slowed growth and spending in these areas, which will result in more and more people with disabilities, including those with MS, ending up in nursing homes, long-term care, or assisted living facilities. On average, according to the Minnesota Department of Human Services, it costs $2,300 per month for a person living independently in the community with a CADI waiver. If those people end up in nursing homes or assisted living, the average cost is $6,700 per month, or $80,000 per year, according to the Citizens League long-term care report issued last year. Clearly, it's cheaper and provides better quality of life to keep people living independently. Short-term savings through proposed reductions will result in higher costs down the road. I also want to just make an observation regarding the super waiver or global waiver that from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that's being discussed. It's been reported that waiver would account for approximately $300 million in savings. As a former congressional chief of staff, I worked with the state of Minnesota on waivers in the mid-90s, and I know firsthand that these waivers can take a very long time before they get approved, if they get approved. And I'm concerned that the $300 million in savings may merely be phantom savings, setting the state up for more serious budget problems down the road. Lastly, we're very concerned about policy language in Section 9. Language to ban human cloning is in this bill. And while we have no objection to a ban of human reproductive cloning intended to produce an independent duplicate person, we do believe that the language as written will ban therapeutic cloning, which is commonly used to generate tissues that match a patient's body and therefore won't be rejected by the immune system. So we strongly encourage you to work with experts in the field to clarify this. Otherwise, we'd ask that you strike the language and give it more time and revisit the issue at another time. I know you have dozens of issues to address, and we have many more concerns than those highlighted, People with MS who end up utilizing these important programs funded through the Department of Human Services are truly in need. They end up needing the services because the disease forces them into these programs. And those on medical assistance wouldn't be there but for the disease and the significant impact it has had on their health and day-to-day life. We urge you to take a fresh look at the budget and work to do no harm. The most vulnerable among us, the sick, the needy, and the people with disabilities, are counting on you. Thank you so much, and we stand ready to help in any way we can.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Just a minor correction. In our bill, we do have the language for the super waiver. We have not attributed to that language any saving. I think the other body has attributed some dollars to that, but we have not.
Okay.
But that's not to say we don't have other waivers that expectations, so I appreciate the point.
Well, and that's why I want to say it's been reported, because I wasn't certain where it would end up here. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Next we have Mr. Ness.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Robert Fisher was actually in the hallway when he was called up last time.
Mr. Ness, we can take your comments, and then we'll go back to Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patrick Ness. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We're a coalition of over 150 organizations, shelter outreach, transitional housing, affordable housing, programs that touch all corners of the state. Our mission is to end homelessness in Minnesota. I'd like to begin my comments by expressing our sincere gratitude to this committee for protecting shelter, transitional housing, runaway and homeless youth, and group residential housing funding. We'd love for each of you to come by one of our sites this summer and see firsthand the lives that you've help protect and lend some basic level of dignity. We do have very serious concerns about the elimination of general assistance and emergency general assistance and replacing it with the adult assistance programs. It merges four distinct programs, cuts about $35 million from it, and passes off to the counties as a block grant. We respectfully ask this body to reconsider this provision. Homelessness has increased nearly 30% in Minnesota over the last 3 years. Over 13,000 Minnesotans were homeless last night. These cuts will undoubtedly raise that number. General assistance is a $203 living stipend for very poor and sick people, the majority of whom have a doctor's note that they are unable to work. This living stipend, meager by any standard, pays their rent, food, co-pays, hygiene items, bus tokens, other basic needs. It's about $6.50 a day, and it hasn't increased since 1986. $203 in 1986, $203 in 2011. Emergency general assistance is a critical tool used to bring people out of homeless. Many who have been languishing on shelter floors, it helps pay damage deposit, first month's rent. It's a really important tool for our outreach and housing workers to get people off the street. Otherwise, they will be sleeping outside, if they're lucky, in a vehicle, and yes, even in winter. Sam Grabarski, CEO of the Minneapolis Downtown Business Council, testified in this committee on March 7th, called both General Assistance and EGA vital programs to improving the business climate in downtown Minneapolis, and they have a very unique public-private partnership. In closing, eliminating these programs will result in losing the federal interim assistance money for those on GA who are applying for SSI. Right now, we're able to recoup that money once they're enrolled on SSI. It will give a complete loss of the only living stipend for 20,000 Minnesotans who are on this program today. And it creates a fragmented system with no uniformity across the state for some of our most vulnerable adults. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your hard work on this bill. For the conversations that we have had, and we do truly appreciate that. You've been asked to stretch a dollar further than perhaps anyone in the history of this committee, with great respect to Senator Berglund. We thank you for your work on this as well over the years. But let me tell you, no one stretches a dollar like the men and women on general assistance to meet their most basic living needs. Please don't take that dollar away. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ness, and we certainly appreciate the work that you've done, and I appreciate the chance to have those conversations.
Thank you.
And let's return to Mr. Fisher, if you are with us here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Fisher. I work with St. Stephen's Human Services, where our mission is to end homelessness. I work with a number of people whose only source of income is GA. These are the sickest and the poorest among us. Another thing I just want to reiterate on is one just cannot walk up the street and say, I want to be on general assistance. I can't work. These are people that have seen a physician and for whatever reason have been deemed unemployable at that, either temporarily or permanently. A lot of what I have to say is just going to be a reiteration of what Mr. Ness said. The thing that I see the most is, and I really feel is on their backs are two of the heaviest burdens, is poverty and chronic illness. While GA makes up about 1% of the Health and Human Services budget, it is literally everything for 20,000 Minnesotans. GA is a candlelight on a pitch black path. While it's a very small amount, it does provide security, basic needs, rent, transportation, medicine, co-pays, laundry, socks and underwear, and a few cell phone minutes in some cases. Once connected to GA, they can be connected to affordable housing, case management, health care, and sometimes federal supplementary security income. This can be the start to a path of complete wholeness. Bad things can happen to many people. It happened to me. I stand here before you as a former GA recipient. I am now a taxpayer, and I can truly say I am grateful for the opportunity and the services that I received. I was a very successful business person in Duluth. I had a health care issue that, along with other complications, caused me to end up homeless and penniless. And through the help of the state, I was able to get back on my feet, reconnect with my church, volunteer, be very involved in my community. And I stand before you on behalf of all people on general assistance saying that this is a very important program and it does help people. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for your testimony and congratulations on your personal efforts.
Thank you. So
good to hear that. Ms. Ginter.
Hello, my name is Lindsay Ginter. I'm an occupational therapist working at Professional Rehabilitation Consultants. I'm asking that you strongly reconsider the elimination of rehab services, including specialized maintenance, proposed in your recent bill. Eliminating rehab services for some of the most vulnerable and disabled people in the state will have a wide range of predictable consequences for both the individuals and the taxpayers. Let me be clear, there is a window of opportunity to provide these necessary rehab services prior to more severe complications. For example, in physical disabilities, permanent contractures that often occur after a stroke, conditions which in most cases are completely preventable, can become so severe that people are no longer even able to sit in a wheelchair. The high escalation of costs resulting from this will then be paid for by basic care coverage. In a setting like PRC, exacerbation of mental health symptoms can result in a psychotic break, loss of independent living, incarceration, self-injury, even suicide. The damage caused by an experiment like this will be immeasurable. My question to you is this. Are you prepared to deal with the irreversible effects of this decision? Without appropriate treatment, the costs will not only be shifted but escalated. The cost to live in a nursing home three times that of independent living. An entire year of OT is 2 days in the hospital. We provided a chart in our handout that we'll send out to you of some of the changes that have come from our skilled treatment. OT is a master's entry profession. We are constantly assessing a combination of factors, adjusting interventions, providing individualized care. That's how we get to these results, results that cannot be achieved by a PCA or other less skilled service. We treat clients who struggle despite the assistance and support that they receive from the other mental health systems that are already in place. We've had great success in reducing hospitalizations, and we do this for an average of $3,240 per year per client. We work with a variety of factors, not just ADL training, as has been previously suggested by DHS. What we do is far from simply baking cookies, which, may I add, is rarely done. Our treatments are evidence-based, and our outcome measures speak for themselves. After the tragedy in Arizona, people questioned, can something be done to prevent this from happening in the future? Your decision on this issue is key to the answer to that question for Minnesota. Because if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. But if you teach a man how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. And OT is inherently designed to give people the skills they need to foster a system of independence rather than dependence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ginter. Marie Cook.
Hi, I'm Marie Cook, the Administrator of Professional Rehabilitation Consultants. Chairman Han and Senators, thank you very much for this opportunity today to be heard. With regards to eliminating rehabilitation therapies, eliminating the coverage will not eliminate the need. Lindsay has just talked about the irreversible damage that will occur without timely and appropriate treatment. Timely rehabilitation therapies have always been the most cost-effective option. Eliminating rehabilitation therapies will not decrease your costs. Regarding the proposed elimination of specialised maintenance therapy, commonly known as SMT, in evaluating whether treatment should be cut or kept, I challenge you to look at the success of the treatment. The evidence is in. Occupational therapy reduces hospitalisations. Occupational therapists keep individuals living independently and out of the hospital. The handout that we just gave you gives specific examples of current clients. That was prepared very briefly, but it is just startling if you have a look at it. I would now like to speak to the points raised in testimony presented earlier this month. Our company, Professional Rehabilitation Consultants, delivers the majority of the specialised maintenance therapy, OT, treatment. I've been employed by this private company for 19 years. We've been treating the mentally ill population since 1991. I was part of DHS's committee that developed the specialised maintenance therapy statute. I was well aware, and I made sure that the rest of the committee was well aware, of the fact that this treatment is appropriate and would be accessed by mentally ill clients. The committee members knew the cost savings of having mentally ill clients access specialised maintenance therapy, and thus developed the statute language to ensure that mentally ill clients were included. Treating the mentally ill population has always been an OT scope of practice. OT as a profession began in 1880, treating mentally ill clients. OT students complete a three-month fieldwork in mental health. All treatment is doctor-ordered, medically necessary, and after the threshold is reached, is reviewed and prior authorised. MA reimbursement is the lowest in the industry. So why don't other companies do specialised maintenance? Here are my thoughts on it. I can't speak for them. I can only speak for myself, but here are my thoughts. The prior authorisation process is very time-consuming, can be subjective, and requires an enormous amount of paperwork. They just might not be able to overcome these hurdles and break through to get their work authorised. They simply can't financially afford the time it takes. There has always been a society stigma attached to the MI population. What we do is very hard. The MI client is the most difficult to treat, but we choose to do it. So how do we survive? Our company is very cost-conscious. For example, our therapists, I hate to say this, are some of the poorest paid in the industry. We don't have fancy surroundings. We have old computers, used furniture. Actually, we bought the old BCA building from the state of Minnesota, and we rent out space upstairs to offset costs. We actually have all their old furniture that any other state agency didn't want to take. We keep administrative costs to a minimum. I'm the building leasing agent, the IT department, the human resources benefits coordinator, and payroll department. I could keep going on, but that's the multiple hats that you wear, keeping administrative costs to an absolute minimum. Our survival is attributed to the bottom line, but mostly to the truly great therapists, the great and dedicated experienced therapists that work for us. Please don't let the state of Minnesota lose this, the experience that they've gained in 20 years of treatment. PRC is one of the finest examples of a healthcare company delivering successful treatment, and I think that's what should be looked at when you're deciding whether or not this treatment is worthwhile funding or not worthwhile funding. Thank you very much, and again, I appreciate all of the hard work that this committee and everybody else has been doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook and Ms. Ginter, and we appreciate the work that you do.
And one quick thing, sorry. On Monday, there was an article in the Pioneer Press, I handed this out to everybody, that talks about, that it's entitled Occupational Therapy is Healthcare Industry's Best Kept Secret. And
thank
I
you.
Encourage you to read it. It applies very much in this circumstance. Thanks again.
Thank you. Mr. Blumenschein.
Mr. Chair, I have a handout, a letter from the bishops.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Troutman Blumenschein, and I'm with the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. We're a statewide partnership in ministry with nearly 1,200 Evangelical Lutheran Church in America congregations that have approximately 800,000 members in Minnesota. We like to say that Lutherans are pretty dense in Minnesota. But I come before you today as a young Minnesotan and a person of faith. I would like to thank you all for the commitment you have made to serve our state. I especially appreciate that many of you serve with the interest of future generations in mind. That makes and to ensure that Minnesota remains a wonderful place to live for many years to come. Here's what I want you to remember from my testimony. Caring for our most vulnerable brothers and sisters has both long-term moral and long-term economic benefits. I have a lot of respect for the hard work you are doing and admire the many steps taken to make government more efficient and a better steward of the common good. As we do this, we must be sure to clearly understand the long-term effects of each decision. In economic terms, if we do not provide funding for people to see the doctor today, we will end up paying much more for them to go to the emergency room tomorrow. In moral terms, if we want to encourage people in Minnesota to look out for their neighbors and care for each other, we should have a government that represents that kind of society. I just passed out a letter to you from the 6 ELCA bishops of Minnesota, 6 Roman Catholic bishops, and the Archbishop of St. Paul in Minneapolis. The letter states the importance of a balanced approach to achieving a balanced budget that avoids devastating cuts in services to vulnerable people. Please prayerfully consider this letter as you continue to develop this budget. Caring for our most vulnerable brothers and sisters has both long-term moral and long-term economic benefits. Currently, there is too much in this budget that does not reflect this important guideline. As a good son, I should also tell you what my mother told me to tell you, that the reason my parents moved to this great state is because of Minnesota's reputation of taking care of its citizens. They wanted to raise their kids among adults who could show them good examples of how to act in life. I am very happy I was born in this state. I am proud that in my church we take care of each other, in my community we take care of each other, and in my state we take care of each other. The services that this committee funds allow for the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of many Minnesotans. Thank you for providing these essential resources, and I urge you to continue to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blumenschein. Next we have Lyndon Galboy.
Hi, my name's Lyndon Galboy. I have a copy of my testimony here, too. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee, and we'd just like to say that this budget bill is full of attacks on the poorest in this state. Here's just a few reasons why it should be voted down in its entirety. First, we're against Section 21, which uses disabled people's federal SSI funds as a bludgeon against their impoverished family members. Section 21 would deduct $150 a month per person from the family's MFIP grant if that family is coping with a disabled family member on SSI. If there were two people on SSI, the deduction would be $300 per month. For a family of three, say one of the three is disabled and on SSI, the MFIP grant for the other two is $437 per month. If Section 21 became law, the family's MFIP grant would be $287 in cash to live on for a whole month for two people. On top of that, the family has to care for a disabled family member. And to top it off, the disabled person has to see their whole family suffer because of him or her. A cut like this has never been carried out in any other state. It basically forces people to break federal law by using the federal SSI grant for living expenses for the entire family rather than for the disabled person as it is intended. Second, we're against the 90-day residency requirement. It's unconstitutional. At least half of the MFIP grant is federal money, and if we're eligible, we're eligible. When we are that broke and that desperate that we need to survive on this paltry amount of money, we aren't moving to other states for fun or for great benefits. We move because we have concrete hopes and plans to make a better life. In this time of economic crisis, everyone in this country should have equal rights at survival. Third, we're against the essential elimination of general assistance, emergency supplemental aid, and other emergency programs by folding them in to the county block grant. General assistance is not a supplement to other income. It's all people have. It's GA or it is zilch. Emergency MSA and the other emergency programs are there to keep disabled people alive based on very clear need. In closing, I'd just like to remind you that a family of three on MFIP in this state gets only $532 per month. That has not increased since 1986. It's far, far below the federal poverty level. A disabled person on GA gets a whopping $203 per month to live on. When we're forced onto assistance, life is already a miserable struggle 24/7. And we don't need any more hate-driven laws to make things even worse.
Thank you, Ms. Galboy, for your testimony. Next, we have Ms. Krinke. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I don't think it comes as any surprise to you all serving on this committee today that the Hospital Association thinks that this bill is a very bad bill. We think that it's a bad bill for hospitals, for our patients, and for the communities that we serve. Looking at the language, we believe that it will lead to thousands, literally thousands of Minnesotans losing their health care coverage. I have a couple quick points that I'd like to share with you. There are many, many provisions in this bill that obviously have a negative impact on hospitals, but the two provisions I want to focus on is that the bill guts the Minnesota Care Program and our prepaid medical assistance program and turns it into a risky experiment with minimum subsidies for people to try and buy private health care insurance. Now, I know that there was a bill this year authored by the chair, the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program. And in that program, that population that was selected to participate in that program was single adults above 133% of the federal poverty guidelines. This bill would now change that to make it so that it's everyone in Minnesota Care and our prepaid medical assistance program above 75% of the federal poverty guidelines. It would also include families and children. This would require a federal waiver, which we do not believe either the Dayton administration nor CMS would grant. So the idea of Minnesota trying to do a change in Minnesota care to allow single adults above 133% could be looked at as a pilot project that's very different than gutting our entire Minnesota care program and our medical assistance program. The other thing I think is important to mention is that everything we've been doing in healthcare reform has been trying to move people toward care coordination and toward healthcare homes. And as people get a subsidy, they are very likely to buy a high deductible healthcare plan, which they will only use when they absolutely have to, and they'll probably come into the emergency room and not be able to pay their copay. So what's going to happen is the hospitals will see increased uncompensated care, and they will not get the preventative care they need because they don't want to pay their deductible. The second point that in this Minnesota Care discussion is, while the Minnesota Care program may need some reforms, I think it's very premature to say that the Minnesota Care program has not served our citizens well. It has. We provide services to about 130,000 Minnesotans with a very affordable care product. So I don't think it's time to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The second point I'd like to make is that we support, and I know you heard from the commissioner today, we support the early Medicaid expansion. And I know that this is very controversial with some of the members of this committee, but I think this bill needs to look at what would be the impact to our state budget, what would be the impact to the citizens served, and what would be the impact to the provider community if it went away. I have some information in closing that I just want to share with you all. I've selected four hospitals, and I've gotten the information on how much government business they do. This is a combination of their Medicare and Medicaid business. So I've picked out four hospitals of some of the members of the committee. So the Fairmont Hospital, 60% of the revenues at the Fairmont Hospital are either from Medicare or Medicaid. So another one on the list is Fergus Falls. Fergus Falls, 66% of the hospital's charges are from Medicare or Medicaid. Hutchinson, 51% from Medicare or Medicaid. Mankato, 61%. The reason I share that with you, Mr. Chairman, is because I know there is a desire to get government out of health care. But for hospitals, these are the patients that we serve. We would certainly like to have better jobs in Minnesota and more people on private insurance. But this is what we have. This is our patient mix. We care for patients who are on our government programs. So we'd like for you to reconsider some of the provisions that you have in this bill. We are committed to work with you and this committee to do something better than what you have laid on the table today. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Harpstead.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jody Harpstead, the Chief Operating Officer at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. We've been serving neighbors in Minnesota now for 146 years. I was thinking about it this morning on my way in. We started in 1865 with orphanages. Our services have changed considerably in the last 146 years, and redesign is not a 2011 phenomenon for us or for the nonprofit human services sector. We're most excited this year about the plan we've put into conversation called My Life, My Choices, a new design for services for people with disabilities in Minnesota, which puts people with disabilities at the center of designing their own life. We believe that people designing their own life with a trusted partner will buy services smarter than we are buying them today in Minnesota, move people with disabilities forward, not backward. And we hope the flexibility of designs like this can be included in this bill before the end of the session. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for your support so far in our conversations about redesign efforts. We've also redesigned our youth and older adult services in recent years, for example, closing our residential youth services a few years ago and focusing instead on our cost-effective and equally effective treatment foster care programs. Given our daily experience with the people that we support and serve in Minnesota, I was disturbed this fall by some of the easy campaign rhetoric about those folks that we serve and support and that this committee is responsible for. So we also look forward to continuing to bring you good information and exposure to the people that we support and serve and that the committee serves as well. And we look forward for the rest of the session to continuing to work with you to find the flexibility to continue redesigning services in a way that brings high quality and cost-effective outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have on the list Ms. Pam Johnson, and I heard earlier that she was not here. I just want to ask if she is here. Okay. We've had some minor adjustment in our testimony. We will hear from Patricia Caldwell, Eric Ratzman, and Julie Ring at this point.
Good
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Patricia Coldwell, and I'm here with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I want to make a few general remarks, and then I'll turn to the other county testifiers to speak on some other aspects of this bill. Minnesota is in a time without precedent, and in that regard, the AMC leadership agrees with legislators who have said that the current system is unsustainable. We would like to continue to explore some of the ideas in this bill to see which of them can result in cost savings without demolishing our social services and public health system. Counties recognize that in this fiscal environment, there will be fewer state resources for counties to carry out their responsibilities on behalf of the state. I do want to remind you that rather than acting as completely independent entities, counties administer many of the programs on behalf of the state. Thus, we think that the state should engage in a realistic dialogue with counties regarding which county-administered and state-funded services you would like us to stop doing or at what level you'd like us to deliver them. Our intent today is to give you information about the impact of these reductions on the public and also on the county's ability to carry them out. At the same time, though, counties have a lot of innovative ideas on how to just make things work on the ground. We would like to explore with you ways to maintain services in the best possible ways, given the limited resources that we will have in the future. In this respect, counties do appreciate the steps that we've identified and that the chair and other members have taken to streamline administration of publicly funded programs. We badly need as much simplification and system modernization as possible to manage the rapidly rising requests for public assistance that we have in this difficult economy. And Ms. Hagelin will say more about that, too. I do want to make a couple of comments about specific aspects of the bill, four specific aspects, and then I'll turn it over to the other county testifiers to provide more detail. First, this budget does include significant reductions to the CCSA grant. As Mary Reagan had indicated before, this money is used to protect vulnerable children from abuse and neglect. Loss of these dollars will compromise the safety of these children and adults. The bill contains other reductions to the most vulnerable, which you said that you wanted to protect, that our other testifiers will speak to also. Second, the budget also cuts several grants that are used by county public health departments, TANF home visiting and family planning as examples, that prevent adverse health outcomes. This appears to us to be both penny-wise and pound-foolish, as evidence has shown that these interventions can reduce future costs to society. Third, counties appreciate that the intent of the federal Medicaid waiver request is to give the state more autonomy over how to deliver services and which services to provide. However, we are concerned about the lack of specificity for the waiver, the timing for when savings would be realized if the waiver were to be approved. And I realize that you're dealing with this differently than the House and the budget, but this uncertainty makes it difficult for counties and others to plan for the reductions in services. We'd also like to assure that in any decision that's made in this area, that counties would not be liable for any of the future cost or growth in the program through property taxes. A fourth item, there is an increase in the cost share for chemical dependency services in this bill from, I believe, 16% to 29%. We did some work last year with the legislature on changing the maintenance of effort and cost share to a flat dollar amount, but we were we did not plan for that level of increase. We have had some discussions, and I think you had some testimony from the Department of Human Services that some of that cost would be offset by the Medicaid expansion dollars, but if there isn't Medicaid expansion, that will create a different dynamic, and we haven't really gotten the numbers on whether that would totally be offset. There are many other aspects of this bill that affect counties' ability to administer state-funded programs, and I will turn now to the testifiers to my left to give more information on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Hahn, probably surmised I am not Eric Ratzman.
My name is
Peggy Hegland, and I am the Family Service Center Director at Yellow Medicine County, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, otherwise known as MACSA. First, let me state that the counties do recognize the difficult decisions facing the legislature this session, and we want to offer to be a partner with the state in looking for solutions as the budget discussions continue to move forward. We would like to thank Senator Hahn and the committee for including the provisions supported by MACSA that aim to simplify and streamline the administrative responsibilities of counties. In a time of growing demand for services coupled with fewer resources, simplifying and streamlining the delivery of service is critical as a means to stretch our limited resources. This will help us to achieve the results we expect for clients and taxpayers. Having stated that, we do have concerns regarding some of the pieces of legislation being proposed. As stated, we are quite concerned about the reductions in funding to the Children and Community Services Act block grant to counties. This grant supports counties in providing services to children in need of protection and services, as well as vulnerable adults. A reduction of $22 million for the coming biennium will make it even more difficult to serve these vulnerable clients and may result in less preventative services as counties need to focus on those core protective services. Next, we are also concerned about the reduction to adult and children's mental health grants. These grants help counties meet the mental health needs of individuals, and reductions to funding will likely result in less services in communities and, unfortunately, increased hospitalizations. Another item of concern for counties is the elimination of child support enforcement grants. These grants assist counties in meeting federal performance measures, which in turn result in counties being able to draw down more federal funding for child support enforcement activities. Loss of funding in this program may result in more children and families in poverty and in need of public programs. It has been mentioned earlier that the combining of general assistance, emergency supplemental aid, MSA, and special needs diet into one block grant would allow us some flexibility. And as you can expect, we appreciate the flexibility. However, the reductions to that grant will actually end up limiting what we can do. One last item we would like to draw to the committee's attention is the lack of funding for the adoption and relative custody assistance programs. If these programs are not funded through this budget, there will be no funding for these programs, which in turn will jeopardize our ability to achieve permanency for children. Finally, there are a number of other items in the budget that will impact the people counties serve. Again, we are a willing partner and will continue to work with the legislature on working towards sustainable solutions to health and human services. Thank you so much for the opportunity to address the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Rang, and I'm the director of the Local Public Health Association of Minnesota. I'm here today on behalf of Minnesota's city, county, and tribal health departments. And I'm the one responsible for the three handouts that just got sent to you. In the interest of time, I wanted to provide you with a little background on the programs I'm going to talk about very briefly today. The Local Public Health Association is very concerned that this budget is short-sighted. We understand that you're facing a serious budget problem and hope to be able to continue to talk to you about solutions to that as we move forward in this process. This budget makes deep reductions in public health programs, all of which show that they produce cost savings. Therefore, we believe this budget bill will result in larger budget deficits in the future. First, our members are concerned about the elimination of family planning special project grants and the prohibition on the department for seeking federal funding for family planning activities. This funding is targeted to women who have difficulty accessing health services and who are at high risk for poor birth outcomes. We know that for every $1 invested in family planning, we save over $4 in Medicaid costs. Second, we're disappointed that this budget completely eliminates funding for targeted home visiting. We know that every $1 invested in this service saves up to $5 downstream in child maltreatment and out-of-home placement costs. As Peggy noted, you've also significantly cut the only source of funding for investigating child abuse complaints at the local level. In addition to preventing child maltreatment, family home visiting invests in the brain development and healthy beginnings for Minnesota's most at-risk children, allowing them to be successful in school and later in the workplace. And finally, we're disappointed, and I did provide you one handout on the family home visiting program. For those who haven't perhaps heard much about it yet this session, there's an overview of the program, some of the cost savings, and some of the partners who are supportive of family home visiting. Finally, we're disappointed that this budget does not mean any funding for the statewide health improvement program, known as SHIP. I've distributed a letter to you today signed by our partners who are supporting SHIP, as well as a fact sheet that describes the program. SHIP was established in 2008 as part of a bipartisan health reform effort to control health care costs by reducing the incidence of chronic disease. Like all prevention programs, it will take time to show the results of this program, and we know you have an immediate issue. But I'd like to stress that we estimate in just 4 years that this investment in SHIP will show a $1.9 billion savings to state health care programs. In 4 years, we'll show savings bigger than the budget target for this committee this year. Without this investment, we believe you'll be continued every year to have to face reductions in the people who are served by healthcare programs, reductions in the types of services provided by healthcare programs, and reductions in provider rates within our healthcare programs. This is not a problem that will be solved immediately because costs are rising in healthcare programs today. SHIP is a real reform program that can have a lasting impact on healthcare costs for individuals in their own budgets, businesses who provide healthcare for their employees, as well as the state budget. We hope as you move forward, you find some way to maintain some level of funding for SHIP in this budget. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Patricia said at the beginning, as your local government partners, we look forward to continuing to engage with you as you move forward in this process.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. We would like to take testimony from Toby Pearson and Kari Thurlow, if they are here.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota. We work together with Aging Services of Minnesota in the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'd like to mention just a couple things to start out. First, discussion of older adult services tends to focus on the cost side of the financial equation, but the fact is that nursing homes and assisted living establishments make significant, measurable, and vital contributions to the state and local economies while providing critical services to our aging population. Nursing homes and assisted living establishments support 112,600 jobs in Minnesota and contribute $6.7 billion to state economic activity. We are often the largest employer in rural Minnesota communities. An investment in older adult services is an investment in vital growth industry that creates much needed jobs statewide. The impacts of this bill that's in front of you on nursing homes would include approximately $45 million in cuts to a total of 5.83%. Those cuts are in the form of the $17.4 million in the low-needs case mix category, which you previously heard from Mr. Hokanson about. This is the PA1 cuts that were discussed, and $27.8 million in non-base rate cuts. These include the single bed, the plan closure rate adjustment, and other assorted cuts that are in your bill. Finally, we'd just like to mention the $12 million cuts in optional services will have an impact, although we can't quantify it, of an unfunded mandate on the provision of dental and rehab services in our facilities, as the state requires but will not reimburse for these services anymore.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kari Thurlow. I work at Aging Services of Minnesota and in partnership with Care Providers of Minnesota through the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to touch base on two different issues. And the first is the impacts of your proposal to the Elderly Waiver Program, which is the medical assistance program that helps pay for waivered services, home and community-based services that help keep seniors out of nursing homes. Many of our members are extremely concerned about the approach to waivered services in this bill. But just sort of before I go to the details, kind of high level, keep in mind that waivered services is an approach that the state has been moving towards for some time, reforming the way we deliver long-term care services. It's extremely cost-effective. The department, I think, earlier this year estimated that for every single individual you serve in a nursing home, you can serve three in an elderly waiver program. And it is what seniors want. This is an alternative to nursing home placement. The Senate Health and Human Services bill has three major areas of concern for us regarding the elderly waiver program. And the first is sort of in the managing of the growth of the program by implementing caseload caps effective July 1st, 2011, but capping them at the June 30th, 2011 caseload rate. Keep in mind that Minnesotans are getting older. We are entering a time where the boomers are now turning 65, and this is an area that is only growing in need. And so we are concerned, as the caseload is capped, where seniors are going to be getting their services.
If the waivered services aren't available, they may either go into a nursing home or go without services, and it is something that is concerning to us. Two other areas that we are concerned with. One is the increasing of eligibility for 24-hour customized living services. This is the highest needs individuals for being served in the elderly waiver program. This program has undergone extensive changes just in the last year. We're concerned about the impact that that particular provision would have on seniors, as well as the changes to the budget caps, to the case mix L, which are kind of the lower needs elderly waiver recipients. While their needs have not changed, their budget caps will change, and we're extremely concerned about what impact that will have on access to care in home and community-based settings. Now, on to the other issue, which is rate equalization. And I'll just be very brief here and say thank you to the committee. The phase-out of rate equalization is something that we have been focused on for some time. We believe that it is a step in the right direction towards changing the way we pay for and finance our long-term care needs. And we believe that this is a step in the right direction. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have and appreciate the ongoing conversation.
Thank you. I want to try to get through the testimony.
I understand
but
that.
I will
be very
go
brief
ahead.
Question. Yeah. I haven't Senator, asked any so far. So.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Thurlow, would you believe that the majority of the 800-plus people under this budget that would no longer be able to receive a home or community-based service and would be at risk of entering a nursing home, might have problems accessing a nursing home bed in some communities? And if they are able to access a bed, would it increase the number of people that would be getting the low rate because they would have lower needs?
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, let me do my best to answer the question because needs vary throughout the state. In some communities, there may be access problems. Currently, the state of Minnesota has 32,000 nursing home beds, and there's pockets in the state where we need, and in other pockets of the state, you know, we have some concerns. Everyone on the elderly waiver program is nursing home eligible. And so presumably they're going to have their needs filled somewhere. And so it's a question that we have and is a concern that we have going forward.
And, Mr. Chairman, the second part of my question is I would imagine a number of those people would be in the lowest case mix category that's being cut in the bill.
Ms. Searle.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm not sure if that's the case. Right now, folks are waiting longer to go into assisted living. The average age in assisted living right now, which is the program we're talking about, is in the 80s. So they might be on the lowest case mix. They might be impacted by those lower budget caps, and certainly we're concerned about that. Or they may be very high needs as well and may not still, because of the eligibility changes to the 24-hour customized living change, may not be able to access the budgets that they need there. So we're very concerned about kind of the whole spectrum.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Berglund. Thank you, Mr. Low. I believe we do have some amendments later today that may be of interest to you as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner, Minnesota Medical Association, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Again, just for especially the new members, Minnesota Medical Association represents over 10,000 physicians from across the state. As you have heard from many already previously, we also have a number of concerns with this bill. And in the few minutes available to me, it's impossible to list all the provisions that we think are both harmful to patients and to our state's health infrastructure. But let me just touch on a few quickly. The repeal of the Medicaid early expansion, the radical change of Minnesota Care Program from a comprehensive coverage to catastrophic-only coverage, the harm to children and families caused by the changes to the newborn screening programs, the retreat from our bipartisan support for health reform just 2 years ago to an overly partisan stance on state planning for health reform implementation, and the reinstatement of the flawed CCDS programs are just a few that we have concerns with. But overall, I'd like to give you a bigger picture and just remind folks here that physicians in Minnesota really take seriously their obligation to provide care and to advocate for the health of their patients. But effective patient care, we believe, requires a partnership not only with the patient, but it also requires assistance from other providers, and it also requires a culture and environment that values health. We believe Senate File 760 dramatically undermines the state's commitment and the state's investment in the health of Minnesotans. The MMA is very disappointed and opposed to the drastic and devastating cuts included in the proposal. We believe that low-income, vulnerable patients will be harmed, and many Minnesota physicians and healthcare providers will be asked to treat these patients with more now having more advanced diseases, since we're not addressing them at the front end through prevention, and to take on more uncompensated care and to absorb the financial cuts that will harm their ability to keep their doors open and to continue to provide jobs in communities throughout the state. Just as a reminder, and I think many of you know this, but simply cutting people off of our health care program does not mean that these Minnesotans will not need care, nor that they will not receive services. Those costs will simply be shifted to the patients, to physicians, to other providers, to hospitals, and to all of us through cost shifting and other ways to pick up those costs. We acknowledge the difficult decisions that you have to make, but we ask you, please, to work as you make those decisions to try to maintain our health care safety net for those most in need. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you. And Senator Berglund,
just one quick question.
I will let you have a question.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Renner, does the MMA have any position on transferring funds from the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund that is contained in this budget?
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think you know the answer. Absolutely, we do. We have real concerns. Those are the number of the pieces that I could not address in the bill. We have strongly felt that the Health Care Access Fund should be used what it was originally intended for, and that's generally the Minnesota Care Program and a few other access programs. And we have real concerns that if the Health Care Access Fund becomes kind of a health care slush fund for the state and shifted over to the general fund, that was not what was intended, and we have that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Renner.
Thank you.
Ms. Okramowicz, again, I hope I've pronounced your name correctly. I know you've been before us before, and whenever I see the name, I always try to remember if I've got it correct. Please correct me if I haven't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, you do a beautiful job. Thank you. And I welcome this opportunity to speak to the committee today. I am Jane Okramowicz. I am an AARP member, and so today I'm representing them, but you also know that I'm president of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Care Coalition, a coalition that includes AARP. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today about the Senate budget proposal and some of its potential effects on older Minnesotans and on the people who care for them. We recognize that you do have a daunting task before you as you work to find a solution to the budget dilemma, and we hope that we can work with you to minimize the impact of our most vulnerable citizens. We are most concerned, as you know, about the repeal of Minnesota's nursing home rate equalization law that is included in this bill. For 35 years, this law has protected nursing home residents from discrimination in care. A repeal of rate equalization will result in an unfair burden. Some have called it perhaps a targeted tax on those who are the private pay residents in these facilities. These are people who have saved throughout their working lives, and they're paying their own way at considerable expense in nursing homes. We should not penalize those who have tried to think ahead and save for their own care. Repealing rate equalization does very little, if nothing, actually, to help with the state's budget dilemma, because it actually will increase costs to medical assistance program by prematurely forcing more private pay residents onto public assistance sooner. I urge you to reject this proposal and maintain our current equitable rate equalization law. We also are concerned about the severe cuts to the waivered services and home and community-based that are proposed in this budget. These reductions, as you've heard, are one of the most cost-effective services that we know will have a negative impact on the ability of people with disabilities including the elderly, to live independently. The $103 million in cuts to waivered programs that enables individuals with individuals now to access home-based Medicaid services and helps them delay a moving into the more expensive and confining institutional setting. These cuts include capping growth in the waiver programs and reducing rates for congregate living facilities. Heard more than 830 Minnesotans, they project, will be expected to end up in an institutional setting, either a nursing home or a hospital, as a result of the cuts. I'd like to remind the committee that on average, as you know very well, that they say that we can serve three people in home and community-based services for one of what it costs to have them in a nursing home. And so actually, it's more expenditures for the state, and they are not receiving care at home where they would like to remain. Our goal should be to help Minnesotans receive the appropriate level of long-term care, one that meets their needs and their preferences in the most cost-effective way. AARP and Seniors and Workers for Quality Care understands the magnitude of the budget dilemma, we really do, and the enormity of the task at hand. We hope that we can find a more balanced approach that minimizes the cuts to the services that help keep seniors and persons with disabilities in their homes and their communities and in quality nursing homes. We look forward to work throughout the process to ensure that our most vulnerable can receive quality care with dignity. And I thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank
today.
You. Okay. Ms. Henry.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We work with children and adults with a variety of disabilities across our state. I'm going to mention two items that are positive for people with disabilities in the bill, and then I will mention four problematic areas out of too many for the time that we have. First of all, we'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for including Senator Sharon's bill on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities that was heard last Friday. This will enable people who've worked before age 65 to benefit from their savings, and this is certainly a move in the direction we need to go. People want to work, and they want to take care of themselves to the extent they can, so thank you. Number two, we are grateful also for the inclusion of the alternative funding for personal care assistance services in Senator Berglund's bill. This is very needed. It's a modest benefit, but it will help a lot of children and adults with mental illnesses and behavioral issues. The four areas of significant problem that I would mention are first, the elimination of optional health care services, rehabilitative services, OT, PT, speech, eyeglasses, prosthetics. This actually goes in the opposite direction of the first good item because people are not going to be able to work if they can't see or they can't get the rehab. So we think this item will definitely cost more than it will save. Secondly, we're very, very concerned about the item that reduces income, cash assistance for low-income families affected by disability, taking away money that the disabled family member gets on SSI. There's nothing like a total and permanent disability to knock you down the economic ladder. And we have worked with many of these families. These parents have worked before they had a child with disabilities, and they want to work, but they need to take care of their child. Sometimes they have to go to school and pick them up numerous times. They've lost their jobs. So this is an extremely harsh cut, and we hope other ways can be found than to do this cut. The third item of concern is requiring enrollment in managed care for persons with disabilities. We think this item deserves a lot more discussion. We've recently closed a major program for people with disabilities due in large part to financial issues. We've had repeated problems with transparency and getting data on especially PCA services. So we really urge that something else be done. In fact, we would recommend for all the administrative costs that that would take to connect people with healthcare homes, primary care clinics, primary care case management, and we think that will really do, I think, what we need to do, which is improve care coordination. And finally, as others have said, we're very worried about the freeze for home and community waiver services and the congregate living rate cut. To actually make a cut that will result in a projection of 580 people being institutionalized is definitely going the wrong direction. It will not encourage independence. Institutionalization promotes dependence. It's the wrong direction, and it, of course, violates important rights of people with disabilities under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Olmstead Decree. So with that, I thank you very much for your service on the committee during these most dire of times. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. Next, Ms. Edwards. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Edwards. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy from Fairview Health Services. Appreciate very much your taking testimony today. I'm speaking on behalf of my organization, more than 23,000 employees, when I share our deep concerns with Senate File 760. I will articulate three concerns that I see. The first one is the elimination of the medical education research funding. This is devastating to us. As most of you know on the committee, my company owns the University of Minnesota Hospital. It's called the University of Minnesota Medical Center. We bought it 11 years ago. With this proposal, the elimination of MERC, which helps my organization and other organizations, we provide hands-on clinical training to new physicians, pharmacists, and nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants. This would mean a $9 million cut annually to us in our residency training program. Loss of MERC will absolutely mean the reduction of training opportunities and consequently a total reduction in the pipeline of our future doctors, pharmacists, and other providers in the state of Minnesota. 70% of the doctors that are trained in the state of Minnesota stay in the state of Minnesota. I think it's critical that we keep the physicians that we train here, and it's difficult to recruit here, as you probably imagine. Second concern, the loss of early Medicaid expansion. On behalf of the patients that we serve, Fairview is opposed to cutting eligibility in Medicaid. The health needs of individuals covered by Medicaid do not go away when you take away coverage, and the costs of care are simply shifted within the system to hospitals and other safety net providers. Thirdly, the Healthy Minnesota program, as you're highly aware, we're very supportive of innovation and reform within state health programs. We're excited about the opportunity to work in that arena. However, we are very concerned about the Healthy Minnesota voucher program that eliminates Minnesota care in favor of a defined contribution. I ask the question, what kind of insurance product can you get for the cost that will leave its enrollees with a high deductible and copay when they can't afford it? We are very opposed to a financial incentives for people to buy insurance that does not cover mental health or chemical dependency services. That really doesn't make a lot of sense. We look forward to working with you and the members of this committee in finding innovative ways to make this work. We thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions? Thank you very much. Next on the list, we have Mr. Todd Otis. Mr. Otis, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. I'm Todd Otis, president of Ready for K, which is an early childhood advocacy group. And I just wanted to make a few brief comments about the child care portion of the bill before you. And first, I want to start by thanking the Senate and thanking the legislature for its support of early learning in the last two bienniums. You guys have been great in tough economic times. You've been able to resist major cuts to early childhood and to child care. We are concerned about the proposed cuts that are in this legislation. I'm going to be followed by Chad Dunkley, who will give you more detail on the front line of providing child care. But we're basically concerned about the 5% cut to providers. We're concerned about eliminating the voluntary home visiting aspect of early learning program that you have, and also the R&R infrastructure that makes child care information available to parents. We think that early learning is the most important foundational part of any child's development. And when we reduce child care access and quality child care, we're reducing early learning for kids. And as you know, the programs in our state are most focused on the most at-risk kids. So we think economists have talked about this is the best return on investment when you do invest in young children who are particularly at risk. And so we earnestly implore you not to cut in this area. We feel that the development that happens in the very earliest years have been documented to show that it's going to last a lifetime. It's either going to lead to a pathway of educational success and jobs and lack of crime and lack of dependence on public assistance, or it'll go the other way. These are the most critical years to get a person on the right trajectory. So we believe that both for the sake of the children and for the sake of the state's future prosperity, resisting cuts to child care, which really is early learning, is something that is really worth doing. Maintaining early childhood as a priority, as you have for the last few bienniums, is a really worthy goal. And I think really with that, I'd like to yield my time to Chad Dunkley, who is one of the leaders in this whole field and knows the nitty-gritty of what happens on a daily basis far better than I do. Sure. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Mr. Dunkley here? Mr. Dunkley, welcome to the committee. We'll have someone get that from you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chad Dunkley, and I am Chief Operating Officer of New Horizon Academy, but I also am President of the Minnesota Child Care Association, which represents 300 child care centers throughout the state that care for over 30,000 young Minnesota children each day. I know you have a monumental challenge. I see you need to cut about $2 billion from this budget, but I do want to say that the reason for your budget challenge today is not the child care fund. In fact, we spend 10% less on helping families get help for child care today than we did in 2003. And Todd mentioned this is really bad policy. We have a lot of evidence about what's best, what is the best investment for the state, and this is certainly one of them. There's been a lot of talk about budgeting for outcomes, and if you started with the whole budget over, you would put early education, child care, and funding to get at-risk families access to child care on top of your list. And I want to talk about this provider rate. I think there's misunderstanding about how the provider rate system works. This is not really about providers. It's about parent choice and access to care. You're talking about a provider reimbursement rate that families get. Basically, they get a voucher. The last time the voucher was tied to the market cost of child care was 2001. There was a COLA increase in 2006. The cost of care has continued to rise 2 to 4% every year during those years, and you're asking at-risk families to go out into the private marketplace, which is 90% private families paying for services, and ask them to go purchase care. It leaves very few options when the proof we have about what the best care is the quality child care. So what we've done is leave at-risk families in a private marketplace with a voucher that's already way out of date, and this proposal proposes to cut an additional 5%. Before, even if we kept up with market rates, we already asked families to spend 10 or 20% of their total gross take-home pay for child care assistance. Today, many families are spending 30%, 40%. Now we're asking them to step up and spend more. And these proposed cuts are not on top of a well-run system. In fact, we're below states like Mississippi and Arkansas in many categories, including income eligibility. We let very few families in this state. We're ranked 42nd on income eligibility, for example. But once you get in, you're often put on a waiting list, which have 4,000 names on it. Then when you get through those barriers, you're handed a voucher that was last tied to the cost of care in your community 10 years ago. We are talking about really putting at-risk families in a position where it's impossible for them to find quality care all at a time when we have the best evidence, economists, business community, others, allies on this issue saying this is the best investment. And it's disappointing that we don't have a champion in the Senate that says, I don't care, this is nonpartisan, this is the future prosperity of our state. That's what early childhood is, about giving at-risk kids opportunities and give their families, their parents, opportunities to succeed in the workforce. Every time you cut this, if you want to reverse the economists, every dollar you cut today is going to cost taxpayers $17 in the future. This is about prosperity, and it is about giving families access to quality. That's the only way. So I do ask in closing that you reconsider your proposal. There's a proposal in the House right now, Representative Jim Abler, to make similar size cuts to child care, but it's done in a much more thoughtful way. It's done in a way that goes along with a lot of the research saying the lowest quality providers that do not meet higher expectations, who do not give you a return on investment, let's adjust those rates, encourage them to move up the quality spectrum, and not do an across-the-board cut. You get similar savings without ripping the infrastructure out from a pretty crippled system and not giving families access. So please consider the House version, not the Senate version. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunkley. Are there any questions? Thank you, sir. Next, we have Mr. Arne Anderson. Mr. Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Arne Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Association of Community Action Agencies, the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. My comments today are going to be exceedingly brief. First, I would like to echo the concerns that we've heard so far today and that we are yet to hear about the impact of these cuts on the Minnesotans with greatest needs. And secondly, I would just like to state that with respect to elimination of the Community Action Grant, that the magnitude of that elimination is far greater than the nominal dollar amounts involved. It's not possible for me to succinctly describe the impact of those cuts because it affects each of Minnesota's 28 community action agencies differently, and those decisions would be made locally. So with that, I look forward to working with you in the weeks ahead, and I'll yield my time to the witnesses to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Ms. Webster.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I appreciate it. Mr. Chair, I'm here to give voice to what's becoming clear is that there are tens of thousands of poor Minnesotans, many of whom are sick and disabled, who will be harmed by many of the proposals in this bill. Today, I just want to focus on four concerns. The first concern being the block granting of something, the new program called the Adult Assistance Program. This block grants general assistance, emergency general assistance, EMSA, and special needs diets. Mr. Chair, one concern with this block grant that we have is that we know that many of the people receiving general assistance do go on to receive SSI. And our understanding is that we get federal reimbursement for these individuals that we're giving general assistance to. And so the savings that is reflected in this proposal may be eliminated by the fact that we're losing a federal reimbursement for these individuals. Mr. Chair, these individuals on general assistance are very poor. Many of them are very sick, and many of them are very disabled. This is a $203 a month grant that represents a lifeline to approximately 21,000 very vulnerable Minnesotans. It helps people leave shelter. It helps battered women who are in shelter, and it's a very vulnerable population. We've testified before this committee that we're concerned about the durational residency requirements in this bill. I stand by my testimony that Legal Aid believes a 60-day durational residency requirement is unconstitutional, and I don't need to say, I think, anything more on that. There's also a $150 SSI penalty in this bill. This penalizes low-income parents and children with disabilities, disabled parents, disabled children. One legal point on this as well. West Virginia District Court has enjoined implementation of an SSI penalty in their state, and just last month, the state of Washington, a district court there, also enjoined implementation of their SSI penalty because they said what was said earlier by my colleagues, that you cannot take these benefits from children for the rest of the family. And I could provide more analysis on that if members are interested. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Rolanda Mason.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rolanda Mason. I'm an attorney with Legal Aid, and I would like to speak today about the defined contribution program contained in this bill. Like many others who've testified before you already today, I'm concerned about what coverage will actually be available to thousands of Minnesotans who this plan will affect, both on the medical assistance and the Minnesota Care programs. So last night, I decided to do a little shopping. I decided to shop for an assumed family of three who have income at 133% of federal poverty guidelines. I assumed parents, two adults, age 35, and a child, age 10. That family's annual income is $24,645, or $2,054 per month. The monthly contribution that would be available to them under this plan totals $391.41. So with that information, I got on the internet and I started shopping for health insurance. I was kind of surprised that I found a policy that the lowest premium I could find was for $190 a month. Okay, maybe this isn't so bad, I thought to myself. And then I started looking at that policy. And I found out that that policy had a $25,000 deductible. That's more money than this family makes in a year. There's absolutely no way that this policy is affordable for this family. And if this family used its contribution to buy this policy, it wouldn't get any health care coverage because it couldn't pay the deductible. So I kept shopping. I found that the most expensive policy that this family could afford would be a policy that would cost $435. That's the $391 that they would get from the defined contribution plus their 10%, which they would be required to pay under this plan, of $43.50. There was such a plan, and it had a lower deductible. It had a deductible of $12,000. Again, completely unaffordable for this family. Despite my best efforts and after hours of looking, I couldn't find a single plan that would be affordable for this family, where the combined cost of the premium and the deductible would be within their income reach. Now, I could talk to you about all the reasons why I think the defined contribution plan proposed violates the law, federal law. But you know it violates the federal law. That's why you've proposed the waiver requirements. But even with the waiver requirements, there are some legal problems with this plan. First of all, the maintenance of effort requirements under the ACA won't allow a waiver for children. And children are definitely included in this defined contribution plan. So I don't believe that you can get a waiver that would allow you to implement this plan for children. And secondly, when I looked at the waiver proposal and I looked at the principles that you said that this waiver would be based on, it said that it would be based on ensuring adequate access to needed services and would enable the consumer to receive health care focused on prevention, disease management, recovery, and maintaining independence. If a family can't get health insurance at all under this plan, these two principles cannot be met. So I don't think even under the waiver proposal that you request that this plan can meet the principles that you've outlined. So in conclusion, I believe that this plan provides no coverage for thousands of poor Minnesotans and raises very serious questions of its legality. I hope that you will reconsider the defined contribution plan and will remove it from this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Karen Sames.
Senator Han, members of the Health and Human Services Committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today on behalf of the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association, MOTA. My name is Karen Sames. I'm a volunteer with the association, and I'm talking about page 70 in the bill, omnibus bill. MOTA urges you to reconsider the elimination of rehabilitation services for adults enrolled on medical assistance. Every healthcare provider knows that quality rehabilitation services offers a great return on investment. Money spent helping people recover from disabling injuries or illnesses or preventing further disabilities saves future dollars in both acute and long-term care. The proposed elimination of rehabilitation services, including occupational therapy, will cost more money than it saves. It's a very bad return on investment. It won't take long for people with physical disabilities to show up in emergency rooms because they injured themselves trying to cook a meal or dress themselves or bathe themselves, doing those daily activities without the adaptive techniques and equipment or assistive technology that occupational therapy practitioners provide. And it won't take long for people with serious and persistent mental illness to show up in emergency rooms because their ability to cope with life situations has diminished without the interventions provided by occupational therapy. It won't take long for people newly diagnosed with strokes, hip fractures, brain tumors, and the like to be moved to long-term care facilities because they did not receive outpatient or home-based rehabilitation services, and they lack the tools and skills necessary to take care of themselves. Imagine two brothers driving home from a Twins game when their car is hit by a drunk driver. One brother is 19 and the other is 22. They were not wearing their seatbelts, so both sustained serious head injuries and other injuries. Under the current bill, they would both receive inpatient care. However, only the 19-year-old would receive outpatient therapies to continue to make progress towards self-sufficiency, have splints adjusted, and obtain assistive technologies to enable independence. The 22-year-old brother would not receive any outpatient or home-based occupational therapy services. He would not have his splints adjusted, leading to contractures, pressure sores, and other complications. He would not be given a chance to learn to dress himself, feed himself, or take care of his personal hygiene needs. He would most likely need high-cost institutional care for years to come and perhaps the rest of his life. When adults on MA suffer disabling injuries or illnesses and are denied access to therapy, they could lose the ability to work, to take care of themselves, and make themselves more dependent on the state in the long run. Occupational therapy is very cost-effective. Why would you eliminate a service that saves the state money? We urge you to retain rehabilitation services, including occupational therapy, for people on medical assistance as you negotiate the budget. We understand the economic difficulties the state faces, and we look forward to working with you to ensure that these essential services remain available to those who need them.
Thank you. Next, we have Sue Watliff-Phillips. And you don't look like a Sue Phillips.
I've been sent here in her place. My name is Mike Davey with Elam Transitional Housing, and we've decided we're going to give our time to Tim Brown here, a lifelong resident of Minnesota and gentleman who wants to talk about general assistance.
Mr. Brown. Hey. Please.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I've been lifelong here in Minnesota for 55 years. I've had a job most of my life. Recently, I've been told that I can't work. I'm unable to work because of my emphysema, COPD, diabetes, other things. And what the GA's done for me is given me housing. I was homeless before I got my GA. The GA gave me the opportunity to live at the SRO building in Mary Hall. Without that GA, I can't pay my $61 a month rent. I can't pay my medical co-payments. It's a vital need for me to have this money. It seems like a lot of money if you add it all up, but it's really not nothing. I just want to say that without this money, I'd be homeless again and just mainly walking the street. This is very vital for me. I just like to say that.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
And if I could just, one detail that Tim left out is he's waiting to get onto SSI because of his disability, and he's actually got a letter here from his doctor simply stating that he is no longer able to work and the likelihood of him ever being employed again is highly unlikely because of his many disabilities. And again, Want to encourage all of you, much as Patrick Ness mentioned earlier, to reconsider the elimination of general assistance for people like Tim and the 20-some thousand other individuals that where it's their lifeline and is going to keep them from becoming homeless again. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davey. Next, Ms. Picard. And before you begin, members and people in the audience here, we are planning to take a short break for sustenance and other needs that people may have about 12:30. I'm expecting about a 30-minute break, so I just want to put people on notice for that. Go ahead, Ms. Picard.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Picard. I'm a physical therapist, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Physical Therapy Association. I want to draw your attention to page 69 of the omnibus bill, subdivision 8. It's line 24, page 69, line 24, subdivision 8, physical therapy. This provision of the bill eliminates physical therapy services for individuals older than 21 years of age. I then want to draw your attention a little further into the document on page 81, your home care services, which would be 81, line 7. Physical therapy, among other rehab services, are being eliminated from home care services, completely eliminated regardless of age. Minnesota Physical Therapy Association is in opposition to these provisions on two grounds. The first is humane. I ask that you think about the devastating impact on the lives of individuals who will suffer strokes, spinal cord injuries, brain tumors, severe trauma. And I hope you think about the people who do suffer from chronic conditions such as Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and the childhood disabilities that become lifelong disability after age 21. All that will have been taken away will not be restored. For these individuals, they will be sentenced to a life of preventable disability and perhaps even life in long-term care facility. And for many of them, near 21 years of age, a long-term life in long-term care. This is an enormous personal price that these individuals are asked to pay. Our second argument is economic. It really seems counterproductive to limit the utilization of medically necessary physical therapy services, the very service that results in cost savings to the system. As movement specialists, we are effective at managing movement and mobility problems associated with the chronic conditions I mentioned above. You add to that low back pain and osteoarthritis. So much evidence coming out on the cost savings involved in physical therapy in terms of preventing more risky and expensive interventions. Additionally, for other chronic medical conditions that you don't ordinarily think of as physical therapy involvement, such as diabetes, heart disease, and even depression, the ability to move and be active and exercise is key to their health, and physical therapy can play an essential role in that as well. Again, we're cost savers. Research is supporting this fact. And because of these cost-saving benefits, models of care are being designed in this state and elsewhere that remove the barriers to physical therapy, and access is being enhanced. Under private insurances and even under state programs in the public schools, access to physical therapy is being enhanced. So instead of attempting to limit utilization of physical therapy, we recommend that your payment policy reflect the trends in healthcare reform that are focused on chronic disease management and keeping people moving, active, and healthy. So we recommend that you enhance access to physical therapy services as an absolutely essential benefit for all individuals under state programs. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Picard. Ms. Reichstad? Hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Close.
Is it Reichstad?
Reichstad, Norwegian.
Reichstad.
Chair Han, members of the committee, my name is Marie Reichstad, and I am the public policy manager for Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. Catholic Charities works to end poverty and homelessness in the Twin Cities through programs for people most in need. Last year, we served over 37,000 of our neighbors in the Twin Cities. Catholic Charities is concerned with many sections of this bill, three of which I will address specifically. First, as you know, this bill merges general assistance, EGA, and other programs into a block grant to the counties, while reducing funding by $20 million over the biennium. It is worth repeating prior testimony today that general assistance is Minnesota's primary safety net for single adults and childless married couples who are unable to work. Typically, GA is an individual's only source of income and is used for personal items, clothing, transportation, and even housing. Catholic Charities provides housing where recipients pay 30% of their income for housing. This means that GA recipients can leverage their $203 a month grant to access housing stability by paying about $60 per month in rent. And that was evidenced by the gentleman who spoke for Elim Transitional Housing, who's in one of those programs. As Mr. Ness stated earlier, no one can stretch a dollar like a person receiving general assistance. Access to affordable housing actually saves the state from shelling out for more expensive programs like emergency room care and public safety. It also provides the community with a better quality of life when our federal Minnesotans are housed rather than living in situations of insecurity. Second, this bill restores GAMC for extremely low-income adults without children. The only GAMC providers that deliver services are in the metro area, giving GAMC recipients in Greater Minnesota no access to health care. Finally, the cut to children's mental health grants, specifically the training grants, are a huge loss. Catholic Charities operates St. Joseph's Home for Children and serves as the first place of contact for children at risk in Hennepin County. These grants are used to provide ongoing education for those working with children who have significant mental health concerns. Many of these children are victims of neglect, abuse, and neighborhood violence. Our staff rely on these mental health grants to keep them knowledgeable about the best interventions in order to deal with the unique needs of children with significant mental health concerns. Like everyone in this room, we know you have a challenging job in front of you. I'm glad it's not my job. We ask that you keep our fellow Minnesotans who rely on these programs for support on your mind as you work on this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rigstead. I would like to make an adjustment in the order of testimony here and invite Maureen Marin, if she is available, to come up at this time.
Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to move up in order. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. My name is Maureen Marin. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Survivor Network. CSN has many concerns on the details of the Senate proposal. However, in the interest of time, I will address just two of them. First, limiting the number of CD treatments to 3 and 4 years or 4 in a lifetime is problematic on many levels. It is known that the incidence of dual diagnosis with MICD is very high. Statistically, studies show from 50 to 75% of people with a mental health diagnosis also struggle with co-occurring chemical dependency. Personally, I am someone who quit counting CD treatments at 8, never started counting the number of times I have been hospitalized for psychiatric reasons. Part of the issue was that those two issues were never treated together, were always separated. I now, to the surprise of many, have long-term sobriety. What if I was not allowed to continue treatment after the fourth one? Most assuredly, I would not be before you today. Currently, although there are earnest efforts to change this, there is no appropriate provider delivery system that addresses mental illness and chemical dependency. There is no other disease in which anyone would consider or accept limiting the number of treatments. If a cancer patient is in and out of remission, there would be outrage, and rightfully so, if that person was told they had used all their treatment opportunities up. They would not be considered a lost cause or unredeemable if their struggle continued. It would simply be the nature of the disease. Please consider reforming the system as opposed to limiting. Increase evidence-based practice such as IDDT, integrated dual diagnosis treatment, something we know works. Secondly, I want to articulate concerns regarding moving people from GAMC to CCDS, the coordinated care delivery system. There are only 4 hospitals that participate, and they are all in the metro area. CSN and other advocacy organizations have collected numerous stories of people with a wide range of medical needs, including mental health, that are unable to access care simply because traveling to the cities is not feasible. In addition, the high deductible Minnesota care proposal is very troubling. $3,000 deductible plans are simply unreasonable. A person making $25 or $9,000 a year cannot absorb that kind of deductible, and in most cases will go without, which leads to high-cost emergency care services. Thank you again for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Merritt. Next, Ms. Conlon.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Katie Conlon, Interim Social Concerns Director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The Minnesota Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. Last week, you each received a joint letter from the Roman Catholic and ELCA Bishops of Minnesota. In that letter, our faith leaders called on you to take particular care to ensure that the poor and the marginalized have access to basic needs and to services that will lift people out of the safety net. Our bishops also noted that the incredible budget deficit suggests a need for both an increase in revenue and cost savings measures in order to avoid devastating cuts to much-needed services. Aside from our belief that the final budget solution should include increased revenue, we have a few specific concerns about the proposed bill. The proposal to move thousands of very low-income people off of state health plans and into the private insurance market is fraught with risk. Risk that people will not be able to afford premiums, deductibles, and co-pays. Risk that people will not be able to afford mental health coverage. And risk that people will needlessly end up in the emergency department or in jail in a state of crisis because they could not get the preventative care that they need. We are also concerned about the elimination of coverage for low-income adults for many therapeutic services and medical items such as eyeglasses and prosthetics. The Catholic Church believes in health care policy that reflects a respect for life, does not allow for public funding of abortion, prioritizes concern for the poor, provides universal access, and does not unfairly exclude immigrants from coverage. Healthcare is not mere commodity. It is a basic human right which flows from the sanctity of human life. We are deeply concerned by the proposed combined cut of $20 million from the various general assistance programs, the $150 reduction to monthly MFIP grants for families who receive SSI benefits for their disabled family members, and the elimination of the Minnesota Food Assistance Program, which helps non-citizens over 50 who can't qualify for federal assistance. The low-income people who receive cash benefits, food assistance, and other help from these programs are already in crisis. These proposals will leave many of our brothers and sisters who are currently in the safety net without basic needs, much less a ladder out of poverty. We truly appreciate your efforts, Chair Hand, to include proposals that protect unborn life. As budget negotiations move forward, please know that you have the support of the Catholic Church in Minnesota to do more to protect our neighbors and friends who live in or at the brink of the safety net. Faith communities will do all that we can to help those who are in need, but we cannot possibly do it alone. We are all in this crisis together, and I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Conlon. Laverne Peterson. Laverne Peterson?
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for letting me come here to speak to you. I thought that worked. Could someone help me?
Yeah. What do you need?
Get a book.
Here you go. You need this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Remember, my name is Levin Piggy. Peter said, I'm from Bemidji, Minnesota. I have cerebral palsy, And I'm not going to speak about your cuts, though I think you really need to think about what program that you really need and what program we can do without. But I am going to show you in a book about my life. When I was a baby, I was the doctor told the people who were taking care of me that I would never walk, talk, move, or even know what was going around me. I won't lie, I would not live very long. About a year later, they took me back to the doctor for checkup, and he was very amazed, and he could not believe the progress that was made. It was because of what I saw lady and the home that I grew up in that did not think that she believed in me and she saw something in me that the rest did not. And now I'm asking you to see us as not a liability, but something that you may be able to please. I do know that we are in a budget crisis. So I do not agree with the message. We have been cutting program for the last 8 years. And if cutting the program really did work, I guarantee you today we will not be in the problem that we have. You may think, but we need more cut. No, what you need is to start realizing that you need to take care of people. Remember, the height is not a dream word. It's not going to hurt anymore. Yes, we wish we did not have to make that. I know it's a burden, but because of the program, what came out of the program, because some people thought, well, let's give it a try. Let's see how far we can get these people. This proves that it never. I would urge everybody to think about it. I also urge everyone to read it, but because it will give you a history of where we were and where we are and where we could be if we do it right. I, like I said at the beginning, I know what it does. I know we do get focused, but when we make a decision like that, let's think about what, okay, who is it going to affect? And who will it affect? Who really needs to be out of welfare? And who could do it out? Everybody that is going to come to you and say, we need a program. We can't have it, or we won't survive. Yes, some will survive without the program, and it needs to be done. But the disabled, the elder, and the needy really need a program. I hope to work with you and help you if you will allow me to down the road. Thank you very much for letting me come, and I will give this book for you to have in your record, and if you want more, there is an address. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next, we have Dr. Tim Burkett. Is it Burkett?
Thank you, Senator Han, excuse me, and members of the committee. I bet you guys are getting tired of listening to all this stuff. I'm sure that this is very, very hard for you, probably as hard for you as it is for us. So I will try to not be long-winded and stay with my few comments here. First of all, I appreciate, as the CEO of People Incorporated that served this last year, 6,500 people with mental illness on more than 40 locations around the five-county area, that you left some specific grants intact, which are one-of-a-kind grants. One is a grant, an apartment program, apartment training program started years ago for people with seizure disorders, which is the only one in the state, and draws in people from all four corners of the state. And secondly, safe havens that we developed several years ago for people who are homeless and have mental illness on both sides of the river, which are one of a kind in the state, as part of a collaborative venture with the University of Minnesota Department of Psychiatry. And thirdly, we have an array of programs for people who are deaf and have mental illness. If you're deaf and have mental illness and live in any part of the state of Minnesota and you want service, you probably end up in our continuum. And we have a community support program that was developed about 13 years ago that serves people throughout the state. You left that intact, too. So thank you for doing that in these very difficult times. Although I will say that the 14.5% reduction to deaf services is going to be really, really hard. So I don't know how we'll deal with that. I'm talking about across the board cut. Two cuts I want to talk about specifically that I'm concerned about is the reduction of $1.5 million to people in mental health crisis. And there's some graphs that the page passed out to you about that. More than 20 years ago, my mom called me from outside the state crying on the phone, and she said, why every time my sister Charlotte goes into mental health crisis do they have to lock her up? Do they have to put her away? Do I have to go behind three sets of locked doors to get to see her? And I said, well, Mother, I think Minnesota is going to start doing something differently. But Minnesota only began doing something differently 18 years ago when you opened the first crisis residence, then called Hewitt Crisis Residence, run by People Incorporated. Now we have a whole array throughout the state of Minnesota of crisis support for people who are suicidal, who are having a hard time. And a $1.5 million cut to that is going to decimate the system. As you can see from the graph, it was about a $10 million savings just for the residential crisis support this last year. And then the non-residential is another $10 million. That's the mobile crisis teams that Minnesota has developed over the years. And then on the other side, you can see how many clients were served. We served 3,500 people like my sister outside locked wards in very inexpensive environments this last year. And our mobile crisis teams throughout the state, not just People Incorporated, as many, many other agencies, served another several thousand. So that's about 10,000 people who in the old days would have been locked up. So, gee, I hope you'll revisit that one. And the second one I hope you'll revisit, it was addressed already by Maureen Morin. Many people with mental illness mask their symptoms with drugs and alcohol. And we've developed, finally in the state of Minnesota, the best integrated treatment possible. And the limitation of the number of times that a person can go through this process, plus cutting the amount to the counties from 16% to almost 30%, the counties are going to have a hard time maintaining this service. And there are going to be really, really negative consequences for people. So I hope that you'll consider amending that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Burkett. Steve Larson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARCA Minnesota, and we advocate for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I'm going to keep my opening comments very brief so that Mr. Rutson can just share one quick story. With what I'm handing out is a summary of some of the impacts of the budget proposals on persons with disabilities. You're going to hear about individual programs and the impact of the budget proposals on those programs, but I thought it would be nice to have a cumulative summary of that. And I'm sorry that Senator Benson had to leave. She had a home visit with us about 6 weeks ago, and she met with several families that had adopted children with disabilities, and unfortunately I forgot to list adoption assistance on here. That was also impacted by the budget proposals. So the one area I am going to highlight is just on line 464 of the spreadsheet, and that's the elimination of optional MA services, which does impact persons with disabilities that are on medical assistance, including chiropractic, podiatry, therapies, eyeglasses, and prosthetics. And with that, I'm just going to have Mr. Kurt Rutson share his experience with that.
Mr. Rutson.
Hello. Thank you so, so very much for having me today. My name is Kurt Rutson with the ARC of Minnesota. I have glasses, and I work a job 14 hours a week, and I need my glasses for my work. Without them, I couldn't see. I would, you know, like many of you with glasses, you need them to read and to do computer work and such. And with this bill elimination, I couldn't do that. And I'm very, very, as it is, a low-income person, as it is. And I just wanted to share with you that I've known from the young age that I would never, never, never be rich in my life, as many of you. I mean, no, or whatever. But the word rich is totally different for me. I'm very, very rich with the mom and dad I have, with the family I have, with the friends I have. And that's how I'm rich. Money isn't really important to me, but I need the money for the things I need. Not so much I want, but I need things, and we need things. And I'm talking just not for myself, you guys. It's not about me. It's about other people. And please look beyond your noses when you think about these things, and think about other people. It's about them too. So I thank you so much for your time, and please do not cut these programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the Chair and Senator Hahn and the rest of the committee members that have attended our town hall meetings or visited our programs, and we look forward to seeing Senator Sharon hopefully down next Saturday in Mankato. Thank you very much today.
Thank you, Mr. Larson and Mr. Russell. Bruce Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson from ARM, and I've often said to Mr. Rutson personally and in other forums that he is one of the most effective, passionate, and lovable advocates for people with disabilities, and I have the utmost respect for him, and thank you for hearing him. I am with ARM, and we represent providers in the CADI-CAC, TBI, waivers, CDCS, ICFSMR, and SILS. In the disability services area, the bill focuses on maintaining adequate services for those now receiving services. And given that this committee has a big target, and must find substantial savings, we think this is a prudent approach. And thank you for protecting the core services for people with disabilities. We recognize, of course, as you do, the concerns of the number of people on the waiting list and some of the impacts that Ms. Henry talked about, particularly around congregate living cuts and whatnot. But we all share the vision, everybody in this room, of everybody who needs with disabilities who needs services get the right amount of services at the right time. And we're proud at ARM that we've been able to work with Senator Lurie and Senator Fischbach is carrying a bill for us this year that help address some of the reforms that we think can open that door and realize that vision. For example, in the last couple of years in our transformation reform bills, we've opened up new worlds of technology that will ultimately save a lot of money, and thank Senator Lurie for that. And also removing some of the major barriers to moving people out of more expensive services that they don't need, like in corporate foster care, along a continuum of other services and dealing with the major barriers, how we pay for their housing.
And we'll be making some refinements this year in Senator Fischbach's bill and with the support, I'm sure, of Senator Lurie, and thank you for your good work. So Senator Hand, thank you for doing all you can to maintain the core services that people need in disabilities and residential services and in-home services and an ICFMR. And we look forward to working with you, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, and also I appreciate the work that you do in your organization.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Ms. Perryman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Deal, and Marnie Moore and I have called on all of you to talk about the clinical programs at Gillette, and I would like to introduce to you, or those of you who haven't met, Margaret Perryman, the president of Gillette, who would like to address the importance of graduate medical education in Gillette's history and in our programs.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare, in addition to the clinical programs that we provide, has a longstanding program for training residents and fellows. Dr. Arthur Gillette, who founded our hospital back in 1897, was on the staff at the medical school and likely had student doctors with him that many years ago. So we've been training students in the care of children with disabilities since 1897. Currently, we train 65 individuals from the University of Minnesota each year in these disciplines of orthopedics, rehabilitation medicine, pediatrics, and pediatric neurology. And in fact, the only training that these residents get in the care of kids with disabilities is in the programs that they have at Gillette. We also train orthopedic residents from Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, Michigan, because of our unusual expertise. We provide unique training for these students in the care of children with disabilities, and MERC funds are very important to us in this training effort. We use those funds to pay the salaries of the residents who have been assigned to Gillette. I'm sure you're aware that residents are paying minimal salaries during their residency year, and that payment is actually required by the hospitals, too. The hospitals are required to support that. We receive approximately $900,000 in MERC funds each year, and our costs for the resident salaries through the University of Minnesota programs is about $950,000 a year annually. These funds actually cover only the direct expense, that is the expenses of the residents who are coming in for training. It does not cover any of the indirect expense, and that all goes all the way from the costs of developing training materials to having physicians provide the educational training up to making sure that they have a good hearty breakfast so that they can do a good job that day. So I really implore you to consider keeping the MERC funding program as it is. It is a very important part of how we in Minnesota make sure we have the next generation of physicians to care for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perryman. Troy Taubenheim. I understand we have somebody replacing Mr. Taubenheim. Please.
Yes, my name is Ann Campagna. Mr. Chairman and members, again, my name is Ann Campagna, and I'm the pediatric chief resident at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for letting me testify about the essential need of MERC funding in our state. Having completed an internal medicine and pediatrics residency training at numerous sites in the state, and now working as a chief resident, I am proud to have benefited from MERC funding. Your proposed budget eliminates all MERC funds, a critical funding source for medical education in Minnesota. So what does a state stand to lose if MERC is eliminated? Hundreds of medical training and residency opportunities that are making Minnesota's physician workforce of the future. The short-term impacts are as follows. High-quality medical education requires multiple ambulatory experiences at a variety of clinical sites, and MERC funding is often the only financial support many of these sites receive. Independent ambulatory training sites will stop training physicians. Family medicine programs, which are already significantly underfunded by CMS, will be extremely vulnerable to closure without Merck. Indigent dental school clinics, which have no other funding source but Merck, will close. The long-term effects of the loss of Merck will be devastating. Medicare does not fund 150 trainees from the Twin Cities. Metro training sites will reduce the physicians they train. Rural communities will find it even more difficult to recruit physicians. Without healthcare services, small communities' economic vitality will suffer. Without an adequate pipeline of physicians, practices across the state, and certainly in rural areas, will struggle to fill roles vacated by retiring physicians. Metro training sites will constrict training to the metro area and be forced to limit the number of trainees covered by Medicare. In summary, the loss of Merck jeopardizes training programs across the state, creating a serious and permanent risk of physician shortages. Further, this cut cannot easily be restored when times are good, and in essence creates a bubble from which communities cannot easily recover. Thank you for the opportunity to challenge this legislation and to make the case that a statewide health professionals training program should remain a priority.
Thank you, Ms. Campagna. Thank you. At this point, what I'd like to do is take a short recess for about 30 minutes to allow members to understand, do some other things, and perhaps allow the people in the audience to take a little bit of a break. But we plan to reconvene at 1 o'clock, and I would just ask members, if possible, to try to be prompt so we can continue. But at this point, we are in recess.